Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture. I'm Robert Bounds. Now, it is a truth universally acknowledged that a struggling artist looking for their big break will be waiting tables or writing advertising copy or also perhaps even dog walking. As well as hunting after roles on the screen or the stage, the budding actor is similarly typecast in another part, that of barista or perhaps staff at a temping agency. Many of us fall into the trap of weighing creative work by the monetary value it provides the maker. Can you make a living off your sculptures or performance art? If so, you've made it. But what if the relationship between artists and their day jobs is more complicated than that? What if having a second line of work can in fact enrich your creative work and not just financially support it? What if there are more reasons than one not to give up the day job? On today's show then, we will be exploring the notion of day jobs, heading to an exhibition in Texas and hearing from an array of artists discussing the jobs they've held or continue to hold alongside their other work. First up on today's show, our inspiration for this episode is a new exhibition at the Blanton Museum in Austin, Texas. It examines the impact of day jobs on the visual arts and features work from dishwashers, graphic stylists and hairdressers, among many others. Monocle correspondent Tomos Lewis sat down with the curator Veronica Roberts to find out more about this unusual choice for an exhibition.
The Day Jobs exhibition is a look at the way that artists working in the United States, the way that their day jobs as janitors or hairstylists or lawyers or nannies has informed their artistic practices. And the show was really inspired by years of conversations with artists. I was lucky enough early in my career to work with artists like Barbara Kruger and Saul LeWitt. And both of them shared with me that their day jobs had been more influential than just about any other thing in their practice. So Barbara shared with me that her work as a graphic designer, working for magazines like Mademoiselle and various Condé Nast publications, really was the fodder for her practice and the critique that she makes with her salient images and text like "Your body is a battleground." I was really struck by that and by that relationship to her lived experiences and her relationship, the relationship between the artwork and her career and this other career that she had. And Saul LeWitt, when I met him, I discovered, and I didn't know this prior to working with him, that he had worked as a receptionist at the Museum of Modern Art. And I was so amazed when I heard who else was working there in various frontline positions. So he shared with me that Dan Flavin was running the elevator. He was the elevator operator. Robert Mengold was working as a guard and in the library. Lucy Lepard was paging books in the library. Robert Ryman was a security guard, and the list kept going on. And I thought, what an amazing, how did I not know that all of these artists, that this experience for them had been so fundamental to their, not just to their friendships, they all, you know, became friends and collaborators in so many ways, but that it also had shaped their artistic work. The show is more than just looking at artists who have day jobs, because frankly, in the US, that's just about everyone. You know, that would mean I would have to do a show of the whole world, but and this show could have been, you know, I think a wonderful version of the show could be done with a completely different set of artists as well. So this is not a comprehensive show. I just felt that this was an overlooked part of artistic production. How have we not examined this before? And I think the way we even learn about artists has been so limited. And I will say I was really motivated to share these stories also because I feel that art is deeply connected to lived experiences and daily lives, and that we have a lot of misperceptions about artists and also about creativity coming from these sort of from spaces that the sort of lone genius artist myth, I thought, was desperate need of debunking and deflating and redressing. And knowing artists and having the privilege of working with closely with artists for more than 20 years, I'm just struck by how often artists are exceptionally hardworking, have other jobs that they are doing to sustain themselves. And then I was really struck by this untold story about the way that day jobs have actually informed people's practices.
And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose maybe, especially if you're an artist at the start of your career, be it an actor or a musician or a visual artist, you know, the assumption is that, you know, if you're waiting tables or, you know, working in an office job of some kind, that that day job is the thing that's kind of holding you back. You know, that there are two separate kind of existences here. There's the thing that pays the bills. There's the thing that really fills the heart and the true ambitions of the artists themselves. So I just wonder whether, you know, you can talk a little bit about whether that is a tension, whether that's like a positive one that you've found. And yeah, maybe some examples from the exhibition of how that tension sort of bears out in your mind, or any examples that you're happy to sort of walk us through that you think speak most clearly.
Day jobs are not just one thing. They can be very generative. Even for the same artist, they can be generative and depleting. And I know many artists in the show, Marcia Cottrell, for example, who worked for Condé Nast and made these absolutely beautiful works on paper that look like solar eclipses, and they almost look like photographs, and they're made with basically an office printer that she's feeding paper into multiple times. And she shared with me how grateful she was that this office printer and her frustration with it and her, you know, she used it so much, led her to think about using it in a creative capacity. But she's grateful that that happened on a day job. But she also said that she feels that just the amount of time she had to spend working, she's only recently quit that job. It was really exhausting and took her away from the studio. So even for the same artist who can both credit their job for being generative, they can also feel exhausted. And I think there's a lot of artists in the show shared how hard it is to be juggling so many different jobs and their time. So it's both. It's generative and depleting at the same time. I wanted to showcase some of the artists for whom it had been wonderfully impactful. And I was really interested in that, tracing that line. And one of the examples I would give is a wonderful artist named Genesis Bellinger, younger artist who is in the show, and she makes these exquisite stoneware sculptures and porcelain sculptures that are often of hands, like female hands with manicured fingernails. Or we have an amazing brush that, like, instead of having bristles, it has fingers with hot pink nail polish on it. And she talks about being an assistant to a prop stylist and having to schlep all over Manhattan, you know, creating these mythical interiors for various magazine ads. And she said she was making very different work before that job, and she took the job because she thought it was kind of fun. It was a set number of hours. It paid pretty well. And it didn't take up mental space, so that when she was done, she left the job behind and could make work. And it really did shift her practice. And she started making these sculptures that are very much informed by photo shoots and this seduction of advertisements. And she talks about how grateful she was. She got this kind of backstage pass to how some of the most seductive images in our culture are made, and that she has channeled that into her work. But the difference is that her work isn't trying to sell us anything, and it's not trying to sell us a watch or a man's tie. So she talks about being so grateful for that job, which she had for many years, and how it really shaped her work. Another example that I love is Mark Bradford, who always speaks about being a hairstylist and very openly and happily credits his experience as a hairstylist working in his mother's beauty shop in LA, a black beauty shop with mostly female clientele. He refers to the beauty shop as his first studio, and where he learned, well, I think it was a place of real material discovery for him, the end papers he was using to protect women's hair during permanent waves became the building block of his abstract painting. And he talks about also it not just being a material discovery, but for him a kind of social paper. He refers to it as sort of a social paper that reflects the neighborhood and the community, and specifically the space of this shop. It reflects that in the materials, and that's really important to him in his abstract you know, these sort of incredible abstract canvases and works on paper he's been making ever since. And I think in the show, some of the works you can sort of pick up on what the day job was quite quickly and see it legibly. And in others, it's more nuanced, and you can sort of it maybe you're reading the label or you're looking at the work and it reveals itself a bit more slowly over time. So there's a wide range of works in the show and ways that those stories are being told by the works themselves.
Veronica Roberts there, and the exhibition at the Blanton Museum of Art is open until July. Next up on today's show, Nate Lewis explores race and history through patterns and textures in his unique artwork. But for the 9 years previously, his practice was as an ICU nurse. I spoke to Nate about making this transition and whether he always had an artistic impulse or it was more of a sudden conversion.
It was like I never grew up drawing or doing anything involving, I guess, fine art. I guess I looked at the form of art that I did growing up was probably like play sports. So it was like understanding the kinetics of my body. So in the ICU, yeah, that's when I first started drawing. It's interesting because once I got deeper and deeper into art and like my practice, I think I realized that there's so much creativity and thinking and working as a intensive care unit nurse as a practice, you know, in itself, in an extraordinarily multifaceted practice. And I was able to see, you know, all of the, I guess, art like within that practice of working as a nurse as a practice, and then just all of the, you know, the scientific elements, you know, that are present in it. And then if you think about a conceptual practice and ideas, and that it was just so rich of so much to learn and understand, and something that I probably, you know, apply to my artistic practice these days. So I wasn't thinking about it as it wasn't like an outlet for creativity, because it was deeply stimulating in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, I mean, there must have been moments, despite the stimulating nature of being an ICU nurse, the pressure out of thought and a lot of the humanity in that, I'm sure that informs your art, your artwork now and your practice now. But there must have been moments when you felt very far away from being an artist in a studio or wherever you do your practice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the time away from working, the times that I had, because I mean, working as a nurse, you only work 3 days a week, which is really nice. So that time away was completely separate from it, for sure. It was definitely a relaxing time, because working as a nurse, an ICU nurse, was not relaxing at all. I think only now I see not only now, but within the last like few years, maybe the deep intersection of my thinking as that spills over into my practice, you know, as an artist from a nurse.
Yeah, and I mean, to take that, I mean, the simple matter of training, I call it the simple matter of training, but I mean, clearly there is deep, rigorous training with a huge amount of responsibility that you need as a nurse. The training that you undertake as an artist, formally or informally, whether you become a fine artist or whether your practice is of a slightly different nature, Nate, I wondered about the training and the idea of rigor that you required as a nurse, whether that has informed the work you make and how you make your work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the rigor, I think that's something I've always had in me. I've had it through a few different elements of my life. And the first one was being an athlete. The second one was like studying for nursing school. And then the third one was being a professional, you know, working intensive care unit nurse. And I think when I started working as an artist, I was still working as a nurse. So my drive to create art, and I think it happened actually like a few years after I started drawing, I had a big breakthrough working with paper, which was like kind of the first creative breakthrough I've had. It was the reason why I had that breakthrough, you know, I really attribute it to working with electrocardiogram rhythms of patients that I took care of. And there was a conviction that I had in creating art, which was related to the conviction that I had in taking care of people and just really understanding kind of like the honor that it was to be in people's lives and to be aiding and assisting to nurture people and the families and the dynamics and everything to a good place. But that rigor that I had, I brought into just working on art because it was a deep conviction, because there was nothing for me. I didn't grow up making art, so I wasn't thinking about the canon of art or anything. I was just making from my heart. The medium I was working with, I thought about it artistically, but I also very much thought about it like scientifically. And like it was like this excavation of this work I was working with, of this material. But I also thought about it like these were memorials to like patients I took care of.
Thanks, Nate. That was the artist Nate Lewis. Now, Regan Moss has a similarly demanding second life, but her day job as an attorney isn't one that she's left behind. Instead, she balances her role as a lawyer with creating and exhibiting wonderful installation works. I began by asking Regan whether having a high-powered day job sometimes takes away your agency as an artist.
I haven't experienced that. I mean, I think if you take artwork as it comes to you, as it is, and don't try, you know, to do backflips and contort yourself to make it into something that it's not, or to assume that you know a lot about it based on who you think made it. I think if you don't do those things, then I don't think that kind of thing is an issue. I think where having a more intensive job and doing it simultaneously to the intensive job that being an artist is really just a where the tension is in the day-to-day, is in how do you stay at that high energy, high intensity, use the word high powered.
The ultimate plate spinning of being a fine artist as well. And as you say, you're exceptionally intellectually and scholastically, educationally empowered in both of those worlds that we feel perhaps are disparate. And that is one of the setups of the idea of this edition of this program, is that we're presuming those are quite different things. And I wondered whether you consider these two things that you pursue as being a day job and the other thing. I wonder how you actually divide your time, Regan.
Well, I think the idea of a day job, that itself, we know what colloquially that means, but I think it's not really a day to night kind of thing. You're the same consistent person or inconsistent person throughout the day and night and everything that you do. So I don't think I really think of one as a day job and or the other as a day job. I do think that my heart's work relies with making art. Like that's the thing that appears to me, you know, and I've lived long enough that I feel like I know myself-ish. It's the hardest to let go of. I don't think I will ever not make artwork or sculpture or some form of tangible communication of ideas. But I will say that something that relates to my work especially, and I think is probably informed by the perspective that I have by working this other, you know, somewhat intensive job and having to reckon with people who come from outside what's known as the art world, you know, on a pretty regular basis, it kind of lends itself to a good degree of perspective, a way of making artwork might be, or the purpose of artwork, if it has a purpose, might be. And so a motif or theme that I keep coming back in my work, and I've made expressly work about this, is just really the idea of, you know, what is imagination? What is creativity? And I think having worked in multiple fields simultaneously, you know, I don't think imagination or creativity or some version of that always have to be thought of as good. I don't think that creativity and imagination are always like moral positions or have moral ideals or moral purposes. I think a lot of our most destructive, cruel, harmful devices or machines or creations also spring from creativity and imagination. So creativity and imagination are a locus or a process for also wreaking great havoc on each other and causing great destruction. So from that perspective, I feel like there are ways to be imaginative and inventive and even creative, you know, outside of just the fine arts or fields that we more quickly associate with creativity. And then there are ways to be within the arts and have a complete lack of creativity or imagination or inventiveness. I think that tends to be harder to spot. And so if you approach both or just life from that perspective, I think it helps make sense of why, you know, maybe being an attorney and being an artist don't seem incompatible or don't have to be incompatible.
I mean, it is perhaps a facile question to ask in a way that I was going to ask you about which side of your brain is working when you're an attorney and when you're an artist, but your artworks are rigorous constructions with a kind of strong intellectual basis behind their making. They are weird, strange to say it, but almost you could imagine there is a rationale, an argued through rationale to these things. I don't want to say that this is artwork made by an attorney's mind, but there is a string that links these two practices that you pursue together. Is that fair to say? There are people that might make work that is similar to yours, similar in its rigor to yours, but who do a very different other job, as it were, for money. And I wonder whether that was a fair comment, actually, that there seems to me to be a string between both of those, we'll call them jobs.
I mean, I think that's beautiful and I appreciate it. And I don't think it's wrong for me. I don't think that has to mutually exclude the idea that other people who are, you know, working rigorously in whatever field couldn't apply themselves towards an artwork with the same kind of left brain, right brain approach. I guess I think even that idea of a categorization, I don't know, we're so entrenched in our culture in patterns and categories, and they make life quick and easy, but they're not always reality. They're not always really based on experience and taking something, again, as it is. And so, I mean, I approach my work as me, and I definitely feel like at my best, I'm an integrated person. And so I'm using everything that I've learned, you know, even this conversation will become, you know, integrated in who I am. And then you proceed from there. So definitely when I'm practicing as an attorney, I think I tend to keep the lights on in the house of creativity. And when I'm making a sculpture, they are very intensive to make, and there's a lot of steps, and I make lots of lists to kind of keep me on track and on the right process. And going back to this idea of creativity and imagination, I mean, I feel like the best thing that human creativity or imagination can do for us is to make us feel less disconnected, both internally and externally. So less of a disjointed person, because we can, you know, imagine what it's like A, to be somebody else, or, you know, B, to make something that we haven't already seen.
You define it beautifully, Reagan, as I thought you would before we got you on the telephone. I don't know whether I should describe you as attorney and artist, Reagan Moss, or artist and attorney.
Maybe artist attorney, or person. Human first, and then it all comes from there.
Reagan Moss there. And finally on today's show, I was delighted to be joined in the studio by the comedian Kathy Maniura, whose whimsical character sketches delight in the oddities of people and things. My favourite of hers are those which gently skewer the art world, including a rather excellent sketch as the long-suffering flatmate of Tracy Emin. And so it's no surprise that for the last 4 years, Kathy has balanced stand-up comedy with working in arts marketing. 3 of those years were at the Tate, and she's now freelance. I started our conversation by asking how she sees the link between those two jobs.
I didn't study art. I came into it through advertising and marketing. I studied history.
Right.
I've always really liked visual art, but it wasn't my dream necessarily.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I met people working at Tate, and sometimes we'd meet people who didn't work there who'd be like, that's my dream. My only dream is to work at Tate.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, oh God, I feel a bit bad because I really love it. But it, you know, it wasn't my passion. And I think perhaps coming in with that outsider's perspective, the art world is mad.
Well, you can see where, you can see where the kind of the reality, you can see where the smoke and the mirrors lie in the art
world. Yeah, and I think there's a particular, to me, there's something particularly funny about, I mean, that's the thing. As a comedian, what I'm always doing, I think, is looking for funny things.
Yeah.
That's just how I operate in the world. Yeah. Just constantly, like,
that works for the rest of us.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes to my detriment, but, you know, constantly trying to notice, like, because I do character comedy as well, so it'll be, like, people's traits. Mm-hmm. So a funny turn of phrase someone has, a weird, like, inflection, a funny mannerism, or just, like, little, at the moment, I'm pretending to be lots of objects. That's the show that I'm writing. So even just weird things. So I think the art world, particularly like public sector art, there's this amazing and very funny clash of the sort of pretentiousness and glamour and self-seriousness maybe of the private art world and of a lot of contemporary artists, not all of them. Some of them are very funny and lovely and chill.
Kathy is making the sound of an asterisk.
Yeah. Okay. Not, please don't come after me. And then the kind of chaos of the public sector and the underfunding, and it's just funny watching those butt heads in the same institution in the same space. And, you know, like, the Tates will host like fashion week parties, but then also, you know, you can't get budget for food at a gallery opening or whatever.
Exactly.
It's kind
the
of
good news
weird...
is the drinks at the opening are going to be Tizer.
Yeah, exactly.
Going to be a nice refreshing glass of tap water.
You get a lot of cheese straws.
Yeah. And so is it simplistic to say, Kathy, that there is a section on the Manure Dictaphone, which is simply things you've noticed that day in the office? Or is it a more subtle kind of vibe report that your comedy begs, steals and borrows from your day job? I mean, are you finding it individual instances? And
I think it can be both.
Yeah.
I think the funny thing was, when I was working at Tate, I didn't do that much material about it. And not even on purpose, but I think there was something holding me back a bit. And then it was only when I left that I started doing like those videos about living with contemporary artists.
You're promising me that's not your self-preservation.
I know, but who knows? But I also had for a bit, I had a contemporary art gallery label that I would like, I made up one that I would read out, which was all, you know, ridiculous. I just love how they're written. That to me is also so funny, the way that art gallery labels are written.
Oh. So give us an example.
Oh, it's all the, like, what was it? It was like the materials are like perspex, potatoes, piss, blood and cum. Yeah. Like, and it's this very serious bit about like this group of artists who like live
semen artist's zone.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I think that's the thing, is it maybe it's just that self-seriousness of, there's a lot of really, really funny, silly stuff in art. And there's a lot of very funny, silly artists. You have people like David Shrigley who are like,
he's a funny man.
Comedians, basically. Yeah. But there's a lot of very funny stuff that people take so seriously, which is kind of like when you're in a school assembly and you're not allowed to laugh and you're like, oh, but come on, this is
We've certainly been there.
Yeah.
We've been there. And I mean, it's having that sort of job and having a job that's in that world that occasionally po-faced, but often fascinating and, you know, enlivening kind of day job is a wonderful one to riff off. Because a lot of comedy that riffs off the drudgery of work, doesn't it? So it's The Office, or it's, you know, it's all these classic things. So you're kind of riffing on the sort of beguiling madness of some of your day job, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think
it's quite tender, your lampooning of it.
Good, because I hope, because I love it. I think that's my favourite kind of comedy as well, is a sort of, I guess, a gentle piss-taking that kind of comes from a place of love. And I don't like mean comedy. And I just think there's something about, in a more general sense, I suppose, about just being in a creative environment with creative people, even if it's not in the same medium, that is so inspiring. And I think visual art in particular, I was thinking about this on the way here, that it's almost like one of the purest types of creativity, because as a comedian, you're sort of completely beholden to the audience response. And you're just kind of desperately trying to please. And even if you think something's hilarious,
you can sort of edit on the go, can't you? If you're losing them a bit, you can reach out to them a little bit more.
Well, but
whereas,
I mean,
an artwork just has to sit there and do what was decided was done 2 years ago. Or
well, exactly. And I suppose that's what I mean. Like, I'm constantly, that's one of the things I love about comedy, but you're constantly trying to read the room and work out, like, what do you want? Is it this? Okay, no, is it this? Whereas visual artists, it's kind of amazing to watch contemporary artists work, because they're just like, this is it. This is my idea. This is how I want it to look. This is what I want to say. And then it's kind of a curiosity how people respond, but they're not necessarily trying to elicit a particular response. So there's kind of a very...
And they don't want to explain it.
No. Well, often. No, often they don't. Sometimes they need to, maybe.
I really want to hear... I'd love to hear what you could do with press releases, because I used to be the culture editor of this magazine and still in that world. And it was fabulous for all sorts of reasons. But the press releases were amazing and continue to be so. I think that's a world where the verbiage of the kind of truth and the kind of truth of the brushstroke, as it were, of the artist is often lost in the vocabulary and vernacular of the art world press release, right?
I think that's kind of what I mean about the interpretation labels as well, is sometimes I think they do the work a disservice where they try and go too far or try and over-intellectualize and often that is what happens when artists actually write about their own work.
What's the current buzzword and the art world blurb?
Immersive.
Okay, phew.
Yeah.
How many agencies are you getting these days?
Quite
a lot of agencies.
Everything's...
It used to be a place where you got a job, and now it's a lot of other things.
Yeah.
Okay, so immersive and agency. These are things that we need to watch out for. In the drinking game of reading an artist's press release, we would be on the floor with the immersives.
I think immersive... I'm trying to think what else. Maybe identity.
Yeah. All the I's and the A's.
Yeah, it's a good, but I love it. The thing is,
it's an easy hand in Scrabble.
It is. It really is. But you know, again, this is what you were saying. Like, but it's also great. I love all that stuff. And it's quite
benign, isn't it? It's not doing any harm.
Yeah, and
it's silly, but it's not doing any harm.
It's nice to have. Sometimes you need people and places that are taking that sort of thing to an extreme, in a way that maybe is a bit silly. But I think this is my kind of pitch on art galleries, is that I think it does just make all of us more creative, though. And that's what being around all of that definitely encouraged me. Mm. Yeah, it's just energizing. Where you're like, okay, well, this person has built this absolutely insane installation that maybe doesn't make much sense to me. And maybe I don't like that much aesthetically. But the fact that they've done that and they had that vision and they followed it through and they've been supported by an institution to do that. It's like, wow, okay, I can probably write some more jokes.
Yeah, and it is that thing. It's quite empowering. That might be another word in the press release. It is quite, nonetheless, it is quite empowering, perhaps, to witness people who have a very sort of slightly solipsistic creative impulse. And as a comedian, perhaps, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're always on a seesaw of confidence and needing that confidence to be boosted by an audience.
Yep.
And I think that maybe working in the art world or working adjacent to it can boost that up. You're kind of dealing with a real selfish form of creativity.
Yeah.
Not unlike stand-up comedy, which is someone standing up in front of a room of strangers with a microphone some funny things in their head.
Yeah, it's funny because they can both be very lonely, I think. There's also a sort of, I guess, cliche of like a stand-up touring by themselves, and it's quite introspective. Like, you're quite in your head, but then at the same time you're so dependent on the external validation I think that's the funny thing about galleries as well. I'm talking a lot about the contemporary stuff, and I suppose to me that's where a lot of the absurdity is, because the artists are alive, but some of the historical stuff is mad is mad as well. And then you get into the big conversations about like what's collected, what's shown, what it means, all of that. But yeah, I think it's...
You could do a whole other series of, you know, Botticelli's flatmate.
Yeah. That's a point, actually.
Leonardo's cleaner, you know.
Yeah, Leonardo's flatmate is quite a good one. She's painted everything.
I mean, Caravaggio, you've got to steer clear of, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, there'd be some dead bodies
actual
in that
murderer.
Flat shirt.
Yeah, that's pretty... Honestly, taking that one home with me. But no, I was going to say, it's interesting being in those institutions and watching kind of everyone bend to the will of the artist.
Yeah.
And for better or for worse, like sometimes that can be quite frustrating, but it's just kind of like, this is the artist's vision. Mm. We have to do it.
I like that. Bending to the will of the artist is what we're all trying to do.
Yeah, I guess.
The jealous Kathy Kittman.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say then that the comedians are the opposite of bending to the will of the audience, aren't you? But...
it's brilliant. Thank you for coming in and telling us.
Thank you.
About, I think also how that all plays into your comedy process, because it really works wonders in those films.
Oh,
long
thanks.
May they continue.
Thank you.
Kathy, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Kathy Maniura there. And check out her Instagram, KathyKathyMM, where you can find details of upcoming shows, including at the Brighton Fringe Festival in May and the Edinburgh Festival Fringe in
August. And that is it for this week. My thanks to Tomos Lewis and all of our guests, Veronica Roberts, Nate Lewis, Reagan Moss and Kathy Maniura. Monocle on Culture is produced by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Steph Chungu, and Steph also edits the show. Special thanks to Emily Sands for her help editing this episode too. We'll be back at the same time next week, but until then, from me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.